at this point since he's home with the Lord. But then we had Be Still My Soul, and the Lord doth undertake to guide the future as he has the past. Thy hope, thy confidence, let nothing shake. All now mysterious shall be bright at last. Be still my soul, the waves and winds shall still know his voice, who ruled them while he dwelt below. Great words in that hymn. And then the last verse, which we didn't sing, Be still my soul, the hour is hastening on when we shall be forever with the Lord. When disappointment, grief, and fear are gone, sorrow forgot, love's purest joys restored, be still my soul. When change and tears are past, all safe and blessed, we shall meet at last. Great, great words of the faith. And some of these hymns are really anchor hymns, you know, that we've got some good worship hymns being developed today, as I've noted before with you. But some of the good ones are really there to help anchor our souls. As you know, I've been going through 1 Corinthians with you, so let's turn to 1 Corinthians 7. I think I left off with chapter 6 last time. And then that time I spoke after that, I spoke on a different topic. So let's take a look at 1 Corinthians 7. I have the New King James with me tonight. So if it's a little different, why, that's because it's the New King James instead of the Old King James. But it's pretty close. Chapter 7 and verse 1. Now concerning the things of which you wrote me, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and are come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment, for I wish that all men were even as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it's good for them if they remain even as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it's better to marry than to burn. And the New King James says to burn with passion. Now to the married I command, not I, but the Lord, the wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And if a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he's willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, a wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, a husband, whether you'll save your wife? And this first section of the chapter talks about marriage. And I kind of titled that one, it's responsibility. Responsibility of marriage. Here, a responsibility of marriage is to protect us from sin. And because we're human, you know, the human body, the human mind is easily tempted. And so he starts off right off the bat, and he says, concerning the things you wrote me. Now, and here's these next three chapters. I think 7, 8, and 9 all deal with questions that the Corinthians had written to Paul. Okay, the beginning of the chapter, he's addressing some of the concerns he had heard about, whether they wrote him about it or not. But the things we have looked at in the past few times I've been with you in this area, Paul writes about many things here, and some of the things he addresses with sexual immorality that we looked at before, and other things in the first couple of chapters. But now he's answering some questions that they posed to him. So this is a response, and there was obviously some response here in terms of sexual immorality, not just what we read about in the last chapter, but the immorality in concerns with temptation. And so he starts right off the bat saying, now concerning the things you wrote me about, and he's going to address those, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. And here we're talking about intimate relationships, okay? We're not just saying shaking hands after the meeting, you know. This is getting into some things a little bit intimate and improper. So he says in verse 2, nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and each woman have her own husband. And that again addresses the idea of kind of a monogamy, the way it's written, doesn't it? It's not saying several wives and several husbands, you know. It says each man have his own wife, and a woman have her own husband. So it reinforces the idea of monogamy, not what we saw back in Solomon's day and David's day and Abraham's day with several wives and concubines and all that. But here in the New Testament, Paul is setting up a one-to-one relationship, or reiterating a one-to-one relationship. And then it talks about the relationship within the marriage. It talks about intimacy within the marriage, of not using intimacy as a tool, a weapon, an argument, or withholding for a battle zone here, you know, within the home. But in verse 3, it says there should be a back-and-forth relationship. In marriage, and it's to the point of verse 4 where the one hasn't control over his or own her body, but as the husband or the wife has needs and they address them, why they should be met. And that goes both ways, by the way. In that particular, that's not just the husband asking for intimacy, but it's the wife also asking for intimacy, and he addresses that in both ways. And then he also discusses the fact that do not deprive one another in verse 5, except with consent for a time you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. So he reinforces a personal relationship, personal devotion with the Lord of the husband, personal relationship with the Lord of the wife in terms of prayer and in terms of fasting. Two things that apparently were quite common back in those days, fasting and prayer, as Paul addresses them quite naturally, as alternatives which might be one reason not for a short period of time not to be intimate. But then it says, come together again so that Satan doesn't tempt you because of your incontinency, or as it says here in the New King James, lack of self-control. Now, I looked up that word incontinency, and that's exactly what it says in Strong's, lack of self-control. But Paul's issue, and he's going to reiterate it later on in the chapter, Paul's issue is one of drive, that we not be distracted, and that we not be hindered, we not have no hindrance, no care, no distraction. He's going to proceed to go into that in the last part of the chapter. But his purpose here is a passion for reaching people, and he says here, I wish that all men were even as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and the widows, it's good for them if they remain even as I. Now, we have no documentation as to whether Paul was ever married. He may have been a widower at this point. Okay? We don't know. Can't say one way or the other. Or he may have been single all his life. But but apparently at this point in time, he's not married. Okay? So he said, and he reiterates this several times in the chapter, of to him, the ideal is not to be married. Because if you're married, you're going to be caring for your spouse. One of your big concerns is to care for your spouse. As a husband, as a provider, and as a wife, for a caregiver for the family, and the anchor at home, okay? So Paul is kind of prejudiced. I won't say, well, Paul's prejudiced in that way. For him, being single was ideal, okay? But he's not saying it's a sin to marry. In fact, later on, he definitely says it's not a sin to marry. But for him, because he wanted to, he was consumed with the preaching and going about wherever the Lord moved him, why he could see the benefits of being single. And also the benefits too, if one is attracted towards sexual desires and temptations, the advantages of being married for protection. Somebody I think spoke here a number of times, as I've heard it a while back, where God took a rib from Adam, right, to make Eve. You know, and the rib is a protection. Right? You know, if you're injured in the chest, you're wounded in the chest, your rib cage protects your heart, and protects your heart, right? Protects your heart, and it protects your lungs as well. Unless you're like me and you have a weak lung and it collapses three times over 25 years. But as far as a bruise or something like that, or an attack from without, why, the ribs are to protect you. And for men, in terms of sexual desires and things, our wives are there, and in that way they protect us. And then it talks about divorce, and it talks about, spend some time in verses 12 through 16. 12 through 14 or 15 particularly, it talks about unequally yoked. Okay, and it sounds like in these cases he's addressing where one of the two have become a believer since they were married. Okay, that's what it seems like, because he's not condemning unequally yoked in this section, so he's not really talking about unequally yoked per se, but he's talking about if one is a believer and one is not. If the unbeliever wants to depart, well, we read it. Let's take a look at it. Verse 12. If any brother has a wife who does not believe, and she's willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he's willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife. Well, sanctified, does that mean that the unbelieving husband is saved? Because the wife's saved? No, that's not what it means, is it? Sanctified means to set apart, right? Sanctified is to set apart. And in this case, here you have an unbelieving husband, right? You have an unbelieving husband in verse 13 who has in the home a woman who is a believer and is hopefully is living the life of a believer and living a life of showing Christ as a wife in that marriage. So in that sense, the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife. Not saved, right? Not salvation, but exposed to a living testimony of the Lord's power in that woman. Okay, same way with the other way around. And it says in verse 14, the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. Nor does that mean that the children are saved. I mean, if the children certainly aren't saved, if both spouses are believers, they have to accept the Lord on their own. Certainly, the children aren't saved if only one spouse is a believer. But they're set apart. They're holy. They're set apart because they're under the influence of one parent, hopefully, that's living the life, that's living the Lord in that marriage. And that's what that section is referring to up to verse 14. Verse 16, how will you know a wife whether you'll save your husband or whether your husband will come to know the Lord because of your testimony, okay? Or how do you know a husband whether you will save your wife, whether your wife will come to know the Lord as her personal Savior? Now that doesn't mean it's going to be an easy road. Right? I mean, we all know of examples probably in our lives, people we've met where one is a believer and one's not, and it's been a long haul. It doesn't mean it's going to be an easy road. But there's an encouragement here by Paul to persevere. Then verse 15, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. That's an interesting verse. I was looking at McDonald's comments on that. It doesn't. He says that doesn't necessarily mean they can remarry, but they're not under bondage in that case. And some people believe that's just talking about a separation and not a divorce. It's kind of a difficult verse to really know the complete completely what Paul was thinking of when he wrote that. But because normally we read of nothing in the gospel where Christ talks about divorce unless it's a case of adultery. And we don't think that Paul's establishing something different here in the case of desertion. So that's a difficult verse to nail down for finality. And then I have down here the responsibility of marriage. It's a responsibility that protects us from sin, protects us from temptation, and its permanence. Okay? And then in verses 17 to 24, he gets into a little bit different direction. But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. And so I ordain in all the churches. And by the way, it was obvious from, I guess, from the earlier in the book, this epistle, and also apparently from the letter he got regarding some of these issues, this issue in chapter 7, 8, and 9, it was obvious that there were some people who were really doubting Paul's authority. And he adds a case, and he adds a point in here, so I ordain in all the churches. This isn't something that he's saying just for Corinth, but this is something that he's established. He says, I would teach the same in all the churches. Later on in the end of the chapter, he says something like, talking about a woman who is widowed, she's happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment. And I think also, I also have the Spirit of God. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't know he has the Spirit of God. It just means that others were saying they were speaking with God's authority, and he was saying, well, I also have the Spirit of God. You know, so it's the kind of context that where people have been calling his authority into question, and he was kind of reestablishing that authority or reemphasizing that authority. Verse 18, was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Don't be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Don't become slaves of sin, of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in the state in which he was called. And the idea there, I think, is that no matter what age of life, what point in life the person became a believer, you know, don't make any radical changes in terms of employment or, in this case, the circumcision. I don't know how you could be uncircumcised. That'd be a pretty good trick. But don't become a Jew. Don't become circumcised just because you become a believer. You know, he says that's not what it's all about. That's not what it's all about. That's legalism. Was anyone called while being uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. And then verse 20, let him remain in the same calling in which he was called. They say that when men get up to about 40, 50 years old, you go into this midlife crisis, you know. And I don't know whether he's thinking of something like that, or because the person accepts the Lord, we should make radical changes, or we should do something different, or we have to do something different because we're a believer in terms of our employment, or in the case of circumcision, in terms of the thinking you have to be circumcised. But Paul says, no. You know, it's kind of like the bloom where you're planted thing. You know, God's going to use you, unless he leads you elsewhere. But God's going to use you where you are when you accept the Lord. And many of us, most of us here tonight, have known the Lord for many years, you know. So it's not an issue with us. But apparently for some of Corinth, who are becoming new believers, felt they had to make radical changes, and Paul is kind of encouraging them here to see how you can serve the Lord where the Lord has you. You know, there's quite a reflection here of people, you know, in terms of employment. You know, Jason's a plumber, Tim's in the postal service, and Jorge's out with computers, and Clint's helping people in the government agency he's in. And so there isn't any one profession for believers, right? and Mike's making grape juice. You know, so there isn't any one profession for believers. You know, Paul doesn't want us to make radical changes. You know, just because we accept the Lord. Now there may be a case where he does exercise people to step out and do something much different. Calls you into something much different. But Paul's saying, as a normal practice, bloom where you're planted, basically, is serve the Lord where he's called you. If an opportunity for a slave to become free, go for it, you know. But he says, once we accept the Lord, we're the Lord's slaves anyway. So we're free, but we're still slaves to the Lord. So in that passage in verse 22, likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. So there's a whole, you know, Paul says, don't worry about making radical changes just because you accept the Lord. You're bought with a price. That's the main thing. We need to remember we're bought with a price. And our real master is the Lord. No matter what kind of profession we're in, whether it's making mulch, you know, which was very popular this week, or whether it's in the mail, or whether it's in teaching, or whether it's in plumbing, or no matter where it is, our main thing is we were bought with a price, and we need to be Christ's. Christ needs to be our master, not just our profession or our boss. So he says, brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. And then he gets into the third part. So I had the marriage, and then I had your calling, was verses 17 and 24. And your calling and its relevance of witnessing where we are. And then I have this last one titled Paul's Passion, verses 25 to 40. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord. Yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has made trustworthy. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that it's good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Don't seek a wife. But even if you do marry, you've not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh, but I will spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time is short. And this is, I think this is probably the main verse in this passage that reveals where Paul's really coming from in this chapter, although he didn't divide it by chapters, but in this area of his letter, this reveals his real heart. This I say, brethren, that the time is short. So that, I mean, he expected the coming of the Lord yesterday, you know? He expected fully to see the coming of the Lord in his lifetime. And that burdened him. It burdened him to reach out and not be distracted, and not be distracted, to have no cares and no hindrances. And he felt, for himself, he felt marriage was a hindrance. But it says, this I say, brethren, the time is short, so that from now on even those who have wives should be as though they had none. Those who weep as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. Those who buy as though they did not possess. And those who use this world as not misusing it. For the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be without care. There's that first one, without care. Okay. I had down no hindrance for verse 29, although the word hindrance isn't in there. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. There's a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own profit, not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction. But if any man thinks he is behaving improperly towards his virgin, if she is past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but power over his own will, and has so determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. So then he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives, but if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But she is happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment, and I think also I have, and I think I also have the Spirit of the Lord, Spirit of God. So in the first part of that this last section, and I call it, like I said, I call this Paul's passion. His discussion about husbands and wives is colored by his passion for serving the Lord. You can see that as you read it, read through here in verse 27. In terms of one who is loose to his, who's lost a wife, okay, his wife passes away, or lost a husband, if the husband passes away, in this other section, his desire for that person is to stay single and really go out and wholeheartedly serve the Lord. You know, you can really see a burning passion as you, if you read through this chapter three or four times, you can see where his real desire is. The Lord's coming back. He was convinced it was coming back soon. And he didn't have any time to waste. But then he clarified the other situation, though, for those that wanted to remarry. I understood the part about verse 30, the part about those who weep as though they did not weep. I don't know whether that's straighten up and step up to the plate. But then he talks about those who rejoice as if they did not rejoice. So the idea is to, whatever you're doing in excess, get on with life and get on with serving the Lord. And I think that's probably the intent of that verse. You know, whether you're in deep sorrow or whether you're in crazy joy, extemporaneous joy, or whether you're just seeming to think you have to buy up every place on the block or every luxury that you can have. Get out of that mindset, you know, those who buy as though they did not possess. Get out of that mindset. Don't get your mind on things. Don't get your mind on your sorrows. Don't get your mind on being so exuberantly, improperly joyous, you know, happy, that you don't realize what's going on around you. Get with it and serve the Lord. I think that's where his main drive is here in that particular section. And interesting, the next verse, 31, those who use this world is not misusing it. That's an interesting one. I don't have a real good analogy for that one. But perhaps they were using that world to get to advance themselves. And to, whether it was purchasing or whether it was in, whatever it's in, perhaps it's to advance themselves. If we're using the world just to advance ourselves and not helping others, not serving others, not witnessing to others, we're misusing the world. We're misusing all this that God gives us, which we saw this week can easily be taken away. You know, I went to bed Thursday night fully expecting 1 to 3 inches of snow. That's what John Paul said, you know. And I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't see my car. There was a whole bunch of snow, but there was trees all over it. All I could think of is that I just got this car in August and the hood's gone, the windshield's gone, and the roof's gone, you know. So it's two little dings on the roof, on the side of the roof, and one little ding in the back, and the windshield was fine. But you know, when you first wake up and you look out there, I don't know what your experience was where you were, you know. But my experience was, wow, I can't even see it, much less tell what's the matter with it, you know. And my neighbor and I just lifted everything off and boy, hardly a scratch. Not a scratch, just a couple of little soft dents, three soft dents, and the mirror broke off on one side. But things can be replaced, you know. Things can be replaced. But people, it's tougher to replace people, you know, and God was really good. So maybe this thing about misusing it is putting too much of an emphasis on worldly things. Because he says the form of this world is passing away. And we don't have time to go into the rest of this, but you can take that up yourself. But Paul definitely, and I'll bring up that last word I had, which was distraction in verse 35. I say this for your own profit, that they may put a leash on you, in other words, keep you, hold you in, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction. And that's the main focus of this chapter, I believe, is to serve the Lord. Realize he's coming back soon. And it's been a long time since Paul went home to be with the Lord. But our theme still is, he's coming back soon. You know, and even so, come Lord Jesus. And so, and what, as Francis Schaeffer wrote, then how then shall we live? Right? As he wrote that a number of years ago, how then shall we live? And that's the question that Paul didn't say in that chapter, but he's basically saying it in the way he wrote it. We need to live undistracted, unhindered, and with no care, as best possible. And to serve the Lord with compunction, to be ready to serve him, be willing to serve him, and be prepared to serve him, to always give an answer for the hope that lies within us, right? Let's pray.